Could you hear the instructions okay in the back? Good enough. Any questions about the meditation instructions? Many of you are veterans, but I think maybe I teach a little differently than some of the... Each teacher teaches a little differently. Any questions about the way the instructions that I offered tonight, do they make sense? Any clarifications about how to work with your experience in the meditation? You're just shy. Please.
I often find that I struggle with kind of falling asleep when I'm meditating with my eyes closed. Sometimes I find if I keep my eyes open, and it helps.
Yeah.
Can you offer any...
It sounds good to me. He was saying that falling asleep, you know, which is very common, so many, especially depending on what time of day, like maybe at night after a long day, depending on how busy, how much you might just be very tired, and closing your eyes can lead to drowsiness. Maybe different if it's first thing in the morning, right after your cup of tea or coffee or something. Maybe you find that there's less drowsiness if you had more energy or alertness. But there's two types of sleepiness, and the antidote, the reason I said sounds good, is because opening your eyes, in this tradition where we tend to sit with our eyes closed, opening your eyes is one of the suggestions, that will bring some alertness, also straightening your posture, taking some deep breaths, maybe even just standing if you're really nodding off. Just right here in the room, come and do standing meditation, kind of. That'll give you some alertness of like, okay, I'm just going to stand up for 2 or 3 minutes until I'm not just nodding off, and then I can come back. That was just an excuse for me to stretch my legs. Then you can come back to sitting if you'd like, but standing meditation also good. But it's a little bit interesting to try to identify, not that you can while you're in the process of falling asleep, but to try to identify what kind of sleepiness is this? Is this exhaustion, you know, tiredness, like actually I need a nap, I need some more sleep kind of sleepiness? Or is it more of a mental avoidance? When the Buddha talks about 5 hindrances, 5 things that make having insight through meditation difficult, and he says that the craving for pleasure that we're all facing, that makes it difficult. The aversion or pain and the frustration around the unpleasantness, that makes it difficult. Restlessness, you know, not falling asleep, but the opposite, when you're just anxious and you're kind of crawling out of your own skin, that makes it challenging. It's a hindrance. Or the sleepiness and the torpor of mind, the slothfulness. And that kind of hindrance is, it's not so much like I need a nap. It's more I'm shutting off because I'm seeing some difficult things to acknowledge about how I create suffering for myself. Or I often, when reflecting on this, think of the Wizard of Oz. You all know this story. The yellow brick road, the poppy field. Right when you're about to get to Oz, you're right. There's no place like home, and you're about to find out that like this is all just an internal coming home, and the pop, like to go to sleep, just knocks you out. The wizard of the ego self, whatever it is, what we in Buddhism we call Mara, says, go to sleep. You're getting too close to the truth, too close to some freedom from the internal forms of oppression and suffering, and so sometimes it's that shut down rather than just I'm very tired. I asked a teacher the same question, and he said, kind of in a smart-assed way, he said, some things are just too important to stay awake for. That, you know, it's like you're getting close to what's really important and then you just check out and fall asleep. So trying to identify, is it that kind of shutdown that's putting me to sleep, or is it really just sleepiness? Because if it's really sleepiness, then the prescription is take a nap. You know, it's totally okay to get sleep. But if it's the other kind, then we want to push through and try to be alert and have the courage to turn towards what maybe we're trying to avoid.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Please. I find when I meditate high on the cushion, I find that my legs go numb by the time I've sat down for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards I need to have 5 minutes just sitting there to get the blood flow going. But I find that it sort of comes and goes. So it's sort of numbing for a little while. Then as about 10 minutes in the middle, it's really numbing and it's affecting me and it's put me off. Then the last 5 minutes and first 5 minutes are normally quite... I don't really notice it.
Right.
Then I find in the middle it sort of comes in numb, and then by the time I get up, I can't move. Is that normal? Why am I hurting myself doing that, or is it just?
I'd have to see. Can you hear his question in the back? Should I repeat it?
Yes.
Good enough. Yeah. I'd have to see how you're sitting. I'd have to actually see what your posture is when you're crossing your legs.
Yeah.
If you are maybe high enough, if you're, you know.
No, I do have a cushion that has me a bit higher.
I'd have to see it to tell you.
Yeah.
Sometimes even in the perfect posture, there's just going to be that experience of the legs falling asleep, and it's just going to be part of it.
Yeah.
Depending on how long you sit. If it's happening like 5 minutes in, there might be a way that you could shift your posture that it wouldn't happen so quickly.
Yeah.
But regardless, it becomes the practice. Mm. The sensations in the body, if it's falling asleep, become, oh, okay, this is... Now I'm being mindful of tingling and stabbing and ice or whatever it feels like.
It does sort of come and go, because like a couple of minutes would be fine, I won't even notice it, and then
right.
I come back and then it starts distracting me again, and then it goes away again.
But this is the point, is don't think of it, try not to think of it as a distraction.
Mm.
Think of it as your practice, the second foundation that I was pointing to tonight. It's unpleasant.
Mm.
Or is it pleasant, or there's moments of neutrality in it, like you said, it goes away.
Yeah.
But not thinking of the physical experience as a distraction at all, but think of it as the practice.
Okay.
This is part of my practice. This is an opportunity to try to develop compassion for the pins and needles of the legs falling asleep.
Yeah.
This is an opportunity. It's a training. It is my meditation rather than a distraction from my meditation. Right, it's the first foundation, it's in the body, it's what's happening in the body. It's the second foundation, it's unpleasant, and then it changes, you start to see impermanence. Like, oh, it was really unpleasant, and then it dissipated, it changed. And now I get to be with that, and now it's sort of neutral, or just the pain going away, now it's pleasant. And I get to be with that, and then you see the craving. I hope it stays pleasant. I hope I can stay comfortable, and then you can see, oh, there's fear here. Because I'm afraid it's going to come back. I know the cycle. It's going to hurt again. And then you get to watch the mind and the body. That is the practice. That's absolutely the practice rather than a distraction from it. Make sense? Yeah, to really be inclusive in that way of, okay, this is happening. And then my own feeling is do whatever you can to find the right posture to limit the discomfort that you're going to experience in sitting meditation, but also accept that discomfort's going to be part of it. And that actually it's a good thing. It's so counterintuitive to think that pain is ever good. But remember, we're trying to transform our relationship to pain. A huge part of the Dharma of Buddhist practice is I want to develop compassion to pain, not as an intellectual idea, but as an embodied reality. And so when you have pain during meditation, here's a real opportunity to practice compassion or tolerance or forgiveness, or, you know, to really get used to tolerating discomfort rather than, oh, this is a problem. And shifting that perspective and say, this is an opportunity. Not one that I'm so happy about in the moment, but in the long run, this is an opportunity. Please.
I think you've just answered my question. I really struggle when I, you know, the posture that I have, I've aches and pains in my back, pretty active life. And the question that I suppose I'm going to ask is, can you lie down and meditate?
Sure. In the first, in the Satipatthana, which is the name for the four foundations of mindfulness, the instructions I'm giving, the Buddha says this formal meditation practice of present time, non-judgmental, investigative awareness, like we're doing, can be done sitting, standing, during walking practice, a formal kind of walking meditation, or laying down, reclining. You can totally do it laying down. Now, the danger of laying down is falling asleep. You know, especially in the beginning, if you're tired and, you know, nothing wrong with it. If you can find a way to lay down to alleviate some of the unnecessary discomfort, if you can stay awake. So you might want to keep your eyes open. You might want to lay down with your palms up, something that's not quite as comfortable. You know, you want to give yourself a little bit of effort in the reclining posture. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of the reclining Buddha. Where he's laying on his side with his elbow out and his hand holding up his elbow like that. So some of the monks and nuns, when they're doing they'll do that kind of reclining posture. Does that make sense? Can you see where you're like like that and kind of resting on your arm? So that, you know, maybe it won't hurt your back so much, but it's going to start hurting your arm after a while. But that will also keep you awake. Mm-hmm. And so there's something good about that. Of doing that posture, so it won't have the back pain from sitting as much, but it'll still be a little uncomfortable. Some discomfort is useful in the practice. And so rather than like, I want to always be super comfortable, or I'm only going to meditate in like a flotation tank. Like, I'm going to be weightless and, you know, in the deprivation tank and totally meditate on my waterbed or on my sofa or whatever, then you won't have the opportunity to actually develop the tolerance and the caring and the mercy, the compassion for the pain. So some discomfort is very useful while we're sitting. Because that's the reality that we live in, right? A body that's often uncomfortable. And if part of why we're meditating is to train ourselves to respond differently to discomfort, not just avoid it, because it's obviously unavoidable, or else we all would have succeeded by now. Please.
Hi, my tie in, it's about breathing and self. I've only been doing it for just over a year, but I find I manage it much better when it's guided, like listening to something, going to know I can really get in touch and something. But when I'm curious, I'm just trying to get an answer with my breath, I either kind of almost hyperventilate, or I can't quite, I know it might sound silly, but I can't feel where it's like through the nose or through the gut. I know that's what people say, that you feel it most in one place or another, but I don't kind of seem to be able to do that, and then I get frustrated.
Well, I have a couple of encouragements. One is totally let go of the pressure of doing it right. Or even sometimes we'll give the instruction that says, you know, let the body breathe itself and don't control it. And then you bring the attention to it and say, I can't do that. I feel like I'm really controlling it. And so first kind of give yourself the permission. My friend Vinny likes to say, you can't do this wrong. As long as I'm sitting here and trying to pay attention, good enough. Maybe my technique isn't perfect, but it's okay. I'm sitting here. I'm doing my best. I don't know if it's in my nostrils or belly, or, but I'm trying, and I'm going to persevere with just continuing to get on the chair or cushion and try to pay attention. And you'll see, I don't know, how long you've been practicing now?
Well, probably for about a year, but for a couple of years before that.
Off and on. And then you said you like the instructions, and that helps you. So listen to guided meditations mostly.
Yeah.
Even in your daily practice, there's so many podcasts, there's so many guided meditations. You know, put it on the iPhone or whatever, put it on the computer, and let someone give you the instructions to remind you to come back to the breath. You'll find after a couple of years, you'll have internalized the instructions and relaxed into the technique enough that maybe you won't want the guided meditation anymore. You won't need it. But in the beginning, guided meditation, my first at least couple years, several years of meditation practice, I listened to guided meditations. I didn't know what I was doing. I wanted the reminder to come back to the present or to the loving kindness or whatever practice I was doing. I think that guided meditations are an excellent support for practice. In the long run, you'll internalize it, you'll know the practice, and you'll be able to set the other person's voice aside. I have a suggestion for everyone that I'm almost sure none of you will take, which is actually get one of the books that has the guided meditation instructions in it. And most Dharma books have some guided, you know, this is how to meditate, kind of. All of my books do, all of my teachers, you know, everybody, we put the guided meditations in the book. Get the book, get a recorder, and read the instructions to yourself. And then listen to your own voice guiding you in meditation. So that you are internalizing your own voice rather than someone else's. Right, so that it's you saying, come back to the breath now. Come back to the present. Try to meet this with friendliness. So that your own internal voice, rather than like, Jack Kornfield's in my head still 30 years later. Right? Because I listened to so many of his meditations for so long that my teacher's voices kind of got in there as the meditation voice. Much better if it's your own inner guidance. Now, most of it, I think, it's a good idea. Think about doing that for yourself. It's hard to hear our own voices sometimes. So maybe one more question, then I'll try to, or two, these last two hands, and then I'll try to continue.
You're talking to a mixed audience with some experienced meditators and some not so experienced meditators. If you were doing this with an audience of complete beginners, would you be using more guidance or about the same?
Than the instructions I gave tonight? Yeah, maybe more. The amount of instructions I tend to give depends more on my mood than the audience. How motivated I feel to, like, I'm going to really do a lot. Or sometimes I feel like, oh, you know, I just want to kind of sit too. I want to enjoy the meditation. I don't want to talk the whole time. But maybe I would give a bit more instructions if there was a room of people who had never meditated before, to guide them through the process a bit. But I also feel like, I want to leave some quiet. I want to let them have the experience without the voice for, you know, at least some 5-minute chunks throughout the meditation.
So,
yeah. And then there was a hand in the back. I'll take the last one.
Reminded me of that, and I've been trying to kind of get back to that place and not really being able to do that. And then for some reason I just started to listen to the sound of silence as well, which has been kind of a new technique and new thing to try and work with. And for some reason they seem to work quite well. The sound of silence seems to be able to kind of open up the space and be able to drop back and watch the mind a bit more. But I just wondered if you'd say a bit more about kind of,
yeah, I will. First, I'd like to clarify for people, if they're not aware of what she's saying, this practice of what we're calling listening to the sound of silence is that ringing in your ears, that high-pitched ringing that if it's too loud all of the time, we call tinnitus. Where there's that really, or like after loud music, where your ears are ringing. but in a meditative practice, you can tune in. Most people can, not everybody, but most people can tune in to there is that high-pitched ringing, and you can use it actually as a meditation object. And what some did you learn it from somebody like from Sumedho tradition? from the monks or nuns. Yeah, so one of the monks, Ajahn Sumedho, got really into this and started teaching this listening to the sound of silence practice. And it is quite good as a concentration and an awareness practice. And I like what you're saying about how it's helpful to see the mind more clearly from that anchor of the sound of the ringing, the sound silence. And then from there, I want to actually go into the topic tonight. I also want to say one more thing to you, and I think you already know it, but just as a reminder of, you know, that experience you have on retreat is not really reproducible in daily life. And those insights that we have when you've been on a week-long or a 10-day or a longer retreat, and you get so concentrated on retreat that you have penetrating insights where you can see more clearly things that in daily life with the you just can't live that kind of concentration in the world, at work and in relationships. Retreat is a rarefied experience, and that's a real insight, but you're not going to be able to probably have it or see it as clearly in daily life. And I know that you already know that, but many of us have suffered quite a bit unnecessarily about, like, I had that retreat experience and I want to keep it, right? And I want to hold it and I want to, and it's just pretty impossible to hold it. So it's, again, it's about letting go, appreciating it, and knowing that actually now my relationship to my mind is going to be different than it was in the end of the retreat or at that point in retreat where I saw it in a more clear way.